Hey everyone, it's Jason from the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 98th podcast. I cannot believe we are creeping up on episode 100. It's insane. Today we have a treat for you, another highlight from the Fretboard Summit back in November. Matt Munisteri, one of my dear friends, one of my favorite people, I think he's a national treasure when it comes to music making, was at the summit. He played a straight set, and we actually have a video from that on fretboardjournal.com and on our YouTube channel right now of him playing Let's Do Something Bad. But he also played a second set, and this set was all his idea. He wanted to do a vintage guitar kind of shootout behind a curtain, a blindfold set, if you will, where the audience members had to guess what guitar they were hearing. They weren't able to see whether it was built by Marden or Gibson or Washburn or the Larson brothers or who knows who. They weren't able to see what tone woods were used in it or the construction methods. They just had to listen with their ears and figure out if the guitar sounded good or not. And of course, in typical Fretboard Summit fashion, we went into overkill and had about 30 guitars backstage waiting for Matt for an hour-long set. So next time, if we were to do this, we would give it about 2 or 3 hours so that Matt could actually get through all the guitars. But you'll be hearing in this podcast what the audience was able to hear. And I thought about making this a video. Ultimately, I thought an hour-long video of you staring at a curtain wasn't that interesting. So we have it as audio here on the Fretboard Journal podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I am very, very happy to say that if this sort of demented idea appeals to you, if you are into old guitars, if you are into great playing, if you are into any of this stuff that we geek out on a weekly basis, we are doing another Fretboard Summit, and I can finally announce it. It is going to be October 14th through 16th in San Diego, California. We are taking over the Rancho Bernardo Inn for that weekend, and it will have many of the same magical moments that the first Fretboard Summit had in a much sunnier place with a lot more hotel rooms, hopefully some great food and beverages, and a lot of surprises. So please, we will be announcing ticket sales shortly. If this at all appeals to you, please come. We'd love to see you there. We'd love to have a crowd like we had last year. It was just fantastic. And I do need to give a shout out before we get to Matt's set to our dear friends at Paul Reed Smith Guitars. Go to prsguitars.com. They underwrote a lot of the videos and podcasts that we were able to record at the summit. They're doing such cool stuff. I know they've got the CE24 bolt-on neck. They've got all these cool S2 models that are super cheap and super awesome. They're just crushing it and doing amazing work. PRSguitars.com. They also, I think, just announced the dates for their next PRS experience. So if you're into events where a bunch of guitar geeks gather and you find yourself on the East Coast, you should sign up for that by all means. Without further ado, here is Matt Munisteri. We have another podcast next week, number 99. And then episode 100, we're going to be unveiling a little podcast series within our podcast channel. I hope you enjoy it. Again, go to fretboardsummit.com for all of your Fretboard Summit needs, and go to fretboardjournal.com to subscribe if you haven't yet. Subscribing to the print magazine is what keeps the lights on around here, and we can't thank you enough for doing that. Matt Munisteri is absolutely one of my favorite guitarists. He's one of the first guys we reached out to when we had this crazy idea of doing the Fretboard Summit. And I asked him if he had any crazy ideas of stuff he could do at the Fretboard Summit. And he gave me like a laundry list of 10 things that will be used and recycled in future Fretboard Summits. But this one, the idea of not being able to see the guitar that you are listening to and how that affects your perception of tone and everything else was intriguing to us, and it involved a curtain, which we already had, so we're gonna do it. There's probably, I don't know, a couple $1 million worth of instruments back there and up here, and we'll just, we'll see what happens. Matt Munisteri, everybody.
Hello. Hello, summiters. We've all summited now. We're at the peak. I'm just starting to peak right now. Egged on as I am by these extraordinary instruments back here. When I was first playing guitar guitars seem to always be described as like, this is a flat pick guitar, this is a jazz guitar, this is a finger style guitar. And being a jazz flat picking finger style guitarist, I think that's all complete bullshit. And the more important thing is to learn the different qualities of an instrument and to develop a technique that hopefully can coax something meaningful with an honest resonance and an honest statement from yourself out of any instrument. So what I'm going to do is play the strings open and fretted and talk a little bit about the things that I think that people should listen for. Sorry, this is a little short for me. So the first thing that I think we should listen for when I play one of these guitars, and we might have some special guests who are backstage also play some guitars, so that's going to throw a wrinkle into the whole thing. Because the bottom line is that whenever someone plays a guitar, you still basically sound like yourself. But in this case, this screen allows me to sound like other people because it'll actually be other people sometimes, if that makes any sense. I would think that the thing to first listen for is it a flat top? Is it an arch top? You know? And if you can sort of figure out that, and what we'll do is we'll show after we play a tune, we'll show what the guitar was. If you can figure that out, maybe think about what are the sides and back. Are they mahogany, maple, rosewood, something else? But those are sort of the big three. Other things that I respond to in an instrument is whether it's a 12 fret or whether it's a 14 fret. There are other things you can hear, like a slot head or a solid peg head. That is also actually affects the sound. With a slot head, you have a steeper break, and the break angle, either at the bridge or at the nut, can mean that you can use lighter or you need to use heavier strings to get the same tension on the top. Those things also affect the sound. So without any further ado, we're just going to play a little guitar. Okay, can anyone see me?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Turn the lights off.
Do we have lights that can be turned off?
Yes.
Really? So can people see it well enough to tell me what it is?
No.
Oh, well, then we're cool. All right. Okay, I'm going to play some notes from this instrument. Beginning, why don't I just begin with the middle G string. The D. Get any sort of impression right away whether it's a flat top or an arch top? Okay. Thank you. would say that the thing that is the real, like, characteristic of this instrument is this ridiculous lows that don't... They're very thick. They push through. This is one of these instruments. You can hear this. These lows don't get cloudy, even coming through a... I know from personal experience, coming through a composite board wall, they'll still be heard. I might as well divulge a little bit. People, I suppose we could do this like a children's game show and people can just scream out their ideas. But I will say, yes, it is a flat top. It also is rosewood. I need to ask the owner, is it Brazilian rosewood? Mark? Who's it?
No.
Michael's going to take a look. Mark said no?
No.
Okay, the answer is it's not Brazilian rosewood, which I think means that the whole Brazilian rosewood craze is a charade. Because the thing that I often find with Brazilian is that the mids cut really well, but on this, the mids are ridiculous. For me, another thing that's interesting about it is the highs. Have a lot of air in them. And to me, that is in kind of in with the 12 fret sound, which for my ears always has a little bit more air and less of a thick sound on the highs. The bass can be nice and bassy. The mid-ranges are tight. The highs are a little more transparent. You can sort of hear through them. They don't, like, you know, they don't bear you. If you're playing in a group, you can sort of hear through other people. It's a nice accompanying instrument. Anyway, it is this. It's a spectacular Gibson Roy Smek Radio Grand, which is a 12-fret rosewood guitar. Where is Mark? Is he backstage?
Right here.
Oh, there. The owner. What year did you say this is?
It's a 1936 Gibson, original sunburst finish on that particular model. Probably red spruce top still. Most people have agreed that except for the 34-35 range Gibsons were not Brazilian, but usually probably Indian. Many of the Chicago, you know, Kalamazoo's only 150 miles from Chicago.
It feels also a little bit like it has a heavier back. It might just be the rosewood, or it might be a little bit of a heavier slab. But in any event, it's a very dense wood. All right, why don't we bring up another guitar? Was that at all enlightening to anyone? Excellent. Okay, the other guitar is coming.
we have a mystery guest guitarist as well, who you can feel free. Well, all right. Why don't we hear the G string? We'll hear everything in the same order. Interesting. Says it's awesome.
Have to say what it is before
go ahead.
I talk about it. No, just that it's an odd combination of things going on here. With the neck is from a what appears to have been some kind of beautiful.
Why don't you guys come up here? Why don't you guys come up here?
Who come where?
You and Eric. This was built as this is a guitar that's owned by Eric Schoenberg, a wonderful guitarist and collector and dealer and guitar historian. Why don't you guys say a little bit about it? It's really a mystery instrument. Did anyone get it? We didn't ask, but did anyone feel like it was flat top or arch top in any definitive way? Flat top. Eric, why don't you tell a little bit about it?
Not much to know about it. It's a freak of nature, kind of. although I've found, since finding this, I found a couple others, so it's not unique. But it's a L00 body, Gibson, with rosewood, which is very rare. But it has and it's sort of like a 50s body with a late 30s L12 archtop neck on it.
But it's kind of a slenderer neck than would be on most archtops, right?
No, that's a 1/11/16, which is kind of standard.
Really?
Well, Gibson was, you know, getting even thinner than that at times. Well, that was later, I guess. And it's actually a little wider here than a Martin.
I'm having the light is on it. Is it a maple neck or a mahogany neck? It's maple.
I think that one's a mahogany neck.
Yeah. But it's just that. Super comfortable. Really comfortable to put it. You know.
Right. It's a part 50s and part 30s. And there's no way to figure out how that happened.
Maybe, was there a moving sale that was happening or something? was Gibson just packing up and going someplace at a certain point?
But in the 30s, a lot of the flat tops had great big fat necks. And then, and with the swing movement coming in, changing the design, the concept of guitars totally. It was a whole new way of playing the guitar. And the arch tops that were getting stealing a lot of the business from the flat tops had necks that were thin, made to play comping chords, four note chords. And I think this is the attempt to do a flat top guitar, but with a modern, more modern neck on it.
This would have appealed to the Nashville scene, definitely. I think they like the fancier peg heads, a little bit of inlay. It's beautiful.
Very, very weird guitar.
Playing it, anything that just, it suggests?
It was, you know, I went, it was just even all the way, and lots of amazing, the overtone thing was super inspiring. You know, I mean, I just picked it up and started playing it this second. And, oh, it's just got that, what are those words you use? Air. All that. It's like talking about.
I'll tell you what, you look at me and I'll just make up some words.
No, it's beautiful.
Those words that you use. Yeah.
No, but it draws, you know, like some guitars. That can be a good thing too when you have to push up against, you have to kind of fight it a little bit. But this was, it sort of led me to things.
That's cool.
It drew things out of me. There's a feeling I get when it's not resisting so much. This doesn't have much. I feel like I could definitely hit on it. You know, you can bang on it, but it's inspiring, this thing. It's great. I'll take it.
Yeah, the next bill comes will be the auction. Instead of actually talking about the various qualities of the instrument, we should just talk about the prices, really. Bill, we are both friends with a great bass player, Greg Cohen. In fact, he gave me, I saw him in Berlin last year, and he gave me the record that you guys did, the California record, which I love. And Greg is a great bass player, and we've talked about instruments that we like, and actually Greg and I both respond to instruments that do fight you a little bit, that offer resistance.
No, and what I like that too. Actually.
Yeah, no, yeah. I know. There has to be like a little bit of an in-between. The instrument has to give you something, and sometimes that means that you have to work for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it's awfully nice when it just arrives, too. All right, let's move on. Bill Frisell. Okay, let's see. We'll find out if this is in tune. Thank you.
I completely, when I was thinking about tunes to play, I completely forgot that. I haven't played it in years, but that's that tune is actually a big clue about the guitar if folks didn't figure anything else about it. I mean, to my ears, the sound is relatively dry compared with some of the other with the other guitars that we played. I mean, and I say that as someone whose playing is very wet. It's really actually true. I tend to coax out of instruments overtones that are often very upsetting to me, emotionally. But this instrument is this is actually really a fabulous instrument. It has a thicker sound in the highs. And the lows do a tight compression. They don't, the note doesn't, isn't struck and then disperses and expands. So right away, do people have an impression of arch top versus flat top?
Arch top.
Yes. Are you sure you guys can't see? What's that sound? What am I hearing? Is it a Telecaster or something? Yes, it's an arch top. You would be correct if you assumed that it was a maple arch top, as the vast majority of arch tops are maple. Just so you can hear what it does when you kind of open it up. It really, you know, it really puts it out. And it's no surprise because it's one of the pivotal guitars of the American experience, a guitar that for some reason, whenever you bring this to a gig, every professional guitarist says, "What is that?" I have no idea why. No one knows what this guitar is, but this is one of the most important guitars ever in the history of the universe. Is it a 1927, 28? 27, 28. Yes, I nailed it. LL5. It's so it should have the master model label. I can't tell if it has it or not. It does. Yes, it has the master model label. This is the first archtop guitar. Lloyd Lohr, the legendary sound engineer, instrument designer, came up with this for the carving of the guitars coming out of mandolin playing in like 1923-24. The early L5s are really interesting and notable because they're a little smaller than they, you know, eventually went to. This is 16 inches across the lower bout. It's a slightly shorter scale also. It's 24.9 instead of 25.4 inches in scale length. I find them that makes them extremely comfortable, and they are extraordinary instruments, and if you have one, it will follow you around like a lap dog for the rest of your days and keep you warm and console you in your darkest hours. And the price for this one?
20-ish?
I think actually they're a little more than that, but maybe, yes, maybe like friend to friend, something around, you know, in the $20,000 range. Anyway, it's a spectacular instrument. And Michael Simmons has been kind enough to loan us this. Oh, yeah, the back, it's nice, you know. I don't know. I mean, it'd be really nice on a Les Paul, but, you know, it's okay on one of these. You know.
What was the tune?
The tune was Janine, I Dream of Lilac Time. And the reason why that suggested itself is that's a tune that Eddie Lang recorded. And Eddie Lang made this guitar very famous. Eddie Lang, I'm sure people are aware of. Salvador Massaro, born in Italy, but raised in Philadelphia. He recorded that tune. And it's interesting, recently I got hold of a record of that same tune that Lang's playing on, recorded maybe like 3 weeks before he did his solo version, and it's with a terrible singer whose name I can't remember, but I mean, it's really like an awful record. And I'll bet what happened was he did the date and he thought, wow, that's a great tune. It's too bad that it was done by that woman. And then a few weeks later, he was given a recording session and chose that tune to record. So let's see what's next. Would you like to do something?
You do this and then...
Well, maybe... Okay, yeah, all right.
As a comparison.
Yeah, okay, this is good.
Talk about it.
Yeah. That's a song that I've played for years, and I always play it blisteringly fast, and it turns out it's really hard to play slowly. So, any observations about this guitar as opposed to the last one? For me, there's a quality that this is kind of a not a very popular type of instrument, but it's an instrument I like a lot. It is an arch top, but there's a quality to the sound that's a little different. A chiminess in the highs. They're a little, what I was saying before, to my ears, they're a little more transparent. This is a pretty even example of one of these. Sometimes, I'll just tell you, Eddie Lang used a guitar very similar to this on his early recordings, and a lot of people thought that it was two guitars, not just because of how well he played and what he did, but I think that sonically it sounded like two guitars. There was the low, and then there's the high. And Lang would accompany. Could hear on the early recordings, you can hear that the lows do this real woof and the highs do a kind of chimey thing. This guitar does that much less, but the reason is, I think for that, is that it's an arch top with a round hole. It's not a Selmer, but it's an L4 and it's a kind of a little later L4, late 30s?
37.
A 37. So, Have they started making F-hole L4s by 37?
Oh, yes, that's all they were doing.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
This year they made some of these.
Okay.
37.
So it's interesting. It's actually a better instrument than some of the other round hole L4s that I've played, which tend to be very... This, again, is an instrument of Eric's. Some of the round holes that I've played tend to have really two totally different sonic spectrums.
They vary a whole lot.
Yeah.
And they changed them a lot, different bracing throughout the period. But super light bracing in 1928, 29, mm-hmm. and then real heavy kerf bracing after that, and then this is sort of in between, it seems.
I had a beautiful one of these years ago, and if anyone bought it, I want it back. I do regret selling it. Like, I sold it because I just really needed the bread, and I didn't sell it for that much money either.
I now have four of them.
We'll talk. Mine had a mahogany neck, which was kind of interesting.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
I think that's more common. Is this?
I have no idea what it is.
It's painted black.
It probably is mahogany. Straight acoustically without a mic, it sounds a lot thinner. You know, that's the other thing folks have to realize. A mic really, really colors things. And Eric and I were talking beforehand. If this were in a small room, we would definitely do it all without a mic. If you're listening without a mic, you can hear. It's a lot drier, and it's a lot thinner. In a band, that's going to cut pretty well, though, because, I mean, I'm really hitting it hard.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much everything I have.
It's also light gauge strings as well, so, which is different than usual.
Yeah.
And a lot of guitars have their sound up front, and some guitars, the sound is way out there. Mm-hmm. Depending on I think F-holes might make the, and arch tops will make them carry further.
Mm-hmm.
Scale length, the longer scale length will carry further, shorter scale length. The sound just envelops the guitar and the player and the microphone.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
There was a great... What's that?
What are the back and sides?
Back and sides are all maple. There was a great rhythm guitar player, Wayne Wright. Anyone ever meet Wayne? He was a New York guy, you know, through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And he just played, as far as I know, just played rhythm guitar. He played in the George Barnes, Ruby Braff group. And he came down to a gig I was playing at almost 20 years ago, and I had one of these guitars. And he was like, no, you got to get an F-hole guitar. He's like, you got to get it. He said, you know, it sounds great up front. And he said, but, you know, you can't hear it when you're like 30 feet away, you know. So.
And it's very telling to compare this to the guitar before, which was the F-hole version, although there's other differences.
Mm-hmm. Well, once they came out, once Lang started playing the F-hole L5, he didn't go back.
Right.
It's like there's a quote that I heard. I'm blanking on the cornetist's name.
Bix?
No, a great cornetist from like the 40s and 50s who idolized Louis Armstrong. And one time the two of them were playing a gig together, and Pop said, you know, if the cornet was so good, everyone would be playing cornet. So that's kind of the thing about L4s, but you can definitely find your voice on them.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. How are we doing for time, Jason?
We got time for one more maybe.
Okay.
Guitar was it?
Small body flat.
Small body what?
Flat top.
Very good. We're getting it now into a new era.
Kind of small. Once upon a time, huge.
Right, exactly. Of the vintage Martins. So this is 1931. More like 30, though. It was like the third guitar in 31. And is it OM18?
Eric Schoenberg has been very generous in bringing a bunch of guitars here and showing up. Eric is also sort of the reason why people even know about the OM. You might tell a little bit of the story. I don't remember. I mean, did you sort of figure out that there's a different scale length? How did you set these apart from the... Because, I mean, at some point... I mean, I should mention, Eric, I've had two copies on cassette of the Ragtime record that you made. I never found a vinyl copy, but the two copies on cassette I wore out between the ages of like 10 and 16, probably.
Uh-huh.
So if you have a copy on vinyl, I'll buy it.
I have it on a CD.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a deal. talk about how the OM kind of came in modern times.
It actually is a large part because of the Ragtime guitar and that record. I had this 00045, which is a 12-fret guitar, and it sounded absolutely incredible, but couldn't play the rags on them. It's only 12 frets to the body. And, you know, you're trying to take a piano piece that, you know, has much greater range and condense it to fit on a guitar. And it's at one point, somehow it hit me, seeing these guitars, that this was the closest you can get to a 12-fret triple O. And in fact, that's how the OM was invented. They took a 12-fret triple O. Harry Bechtel wanted to play swing on his 12-fret Martin, so he asked them to extend it, and they took the body shape and cut it down to expose two more frets. Thus, the 14 fret Martin was born. That's the, of course, you know, Perry apparently played as Martin for a little while and then went out and bought a 16-inch L5.
Yeah, I was talking with I met an old violinist years ago who used to lead a band at the Rainbow Room in New York in the 1930s, and he was talking about playing these private parties for Al Capone and all this, and he had this trio. And I said, well, what was it like? You played every night at this supper club, and people were having dinner and dancing, and you had a trio that was violin and guitar and congas. And the conga player doubled on bass, too, so sometimes he'd play conga, sometimes he'd play bass. And I said, were people dancing to that? Did they hear it? And he said, yeah. And I said, and there was no microphone at all in the room? And he said, no, there was no microphone. My guitarist had a Gibson L5.
Right.
And I was like, okay. And then he said something else. And people were quieter.
Right.
He was like, the world was quieter. And then he died. I don't know where he is now. But anyway, Eric, that's beautiful. I also have an OM-18 that's a great instrument that I was fortunate enough that Eric introduced me to.
Onward.
What shall the last one be? We have time for one more quick one.
Very quick.
Very quick. Tune. Oh, I should mention also that tune that Eric played is one of my favorite tunes in the universe, Miss the Mississippi. Yeah. It's a great song. My favorite version is actually the Merle Haggard Salute record version. And Bill, why don't you show the good people this instrument, because we're going to have to stop. So.
Oh, yeah.
That's a national tricone. I don't really know anything about these, except that I assume that if it's called a tricone, it has three cones. And that's only because I'm a Latin scholar. Michael, would you say something about the tricone?
Sure. Well, the tricone in its earliest form was actually a square neck Hawaiian. It was designed by the Dopera brothers. They used to, before they did guitars, they used to work in a Victrola, these repair Victrolas. And there's a style of cone inside, a little aluminum cone in the orthophonic. And they thought, well, if we make it big, well, maybe we can amplify guitars that way. And so Hawaiian music was really big at the time in the late 20s. And they came up with this three cone system, which is actually kind of complicated and kind of prone to buzzing with the big square neck. They made a few round necks. It would maybe like 10 square necks to one round neck, because nobody really cared. They became obsolete almost instantly when electric guitars came along. You didn't need to have acoustic amplification or acoustic resonators when you had to plug them in. They were not well known in the blues world. Tampa Red played a round neck, one guy. Probably the most famous player and a guy you should really check out is Oscar Alemán. He was an Argentine guitar player, a brilliant jazz player who had the atrocious luck to wind up in Paris in the 30s where Django was king, and no matter how good you were, you couldn't compete with Django. Oscar was a fine jazz player. Had a couple of tricones. He was in Paris when the Nazis invaded. He got out, but the guitars were confiscated to be melted down for the war effort by the Nazis, and so he never recorded with them when he went back to South America. But they're scarce as round necks. One really weird feature, it's an 11-fret guitar, so there's not a lot of frets up there. And so, but they're great sounding. They're this mellower and sweeter, I think, than the single cone instruments. Not as great for blues, but wonderful for jazz. They finger pick really well, as long as you don't need to go above the 10th fret.
And who would need to go above the 10th fret? With that, we will bid farewell. Thank you to the cats that played and the guys that loaned the instruments.